Good morning, counsel. This is the case of State versus Lotter. We will begin with introductions from the court. And I should note that Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter. I am Mike Hevigan, the Chief Justice. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
And now by order of by seniority as to time served on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Jeff Funk. Good morning.
And Jonathan Papik.
Thank you, members of the court. And as noted, Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter. Counsel, Ms. Woodman, are you here with us today?
I am, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. And Mr. Smith, are you with us today?
Yes, I am.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Does either counsel have any questions before we begin today?
I have just one question. I don't recall whether one can reserve rebuttal time.
You may reserve rebuttal time. Each side has 10 minutes.
Right.
So do you you wish to reserve?
I do. I wish to reserve, I think I'll reserve 1 minute.
Very good. And the timer will take that into account.
Okay.
With that, Ms. Woodman, you may proceed.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Rebecca Woodman appearing pro hoc vice on behalf of John Lotter. I would like to submit the issues pertaining to the referendum on the brief. We've briefed those in the brief submitted to the court, so we'll submit those on the brief. The issue I want to talk about here is that an evidentiary hearing is required in this case because Mr. Lotter presented facts in his post-conviction petition that, if proved true, demonstrate that he is intellectually disabled and thus within the class of persons for whom execution is categorically prohibited under the 8th and 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and Nebraska law, and that he is actually innocent of the death penalty. Mr. Lotter's claim arose in March 2018 following comprehensive investigation and an expert's extensive review of records, interviews of witnesses, and evaluation and testing performed in accordance with current medical standards that showed subaverage intellectual functioning with an IQ score of 67, and that Mr. Lotter exhibits concurrent and significant deficits in all three domains of adaptive behavior, social, practical, and conceptual, that have been present since childhood. The expert concluded to a degree of scientific certainty that Mr. Lotter qualifies for a diagnosis of intellectual disability. Mr. Lotter then filed his amended post-conviction motion raising his intellectual disability claim and requesting an evidentiary hearing within a few weeks of the expert's diagnosis. These extensive facts supporting Mr. Lotter's intellectual disability claim are unrefuted. Instead, the state argued and the district court held that Mr. Lotter's claim is statutory and not constitutional and was time barred and procedurally barred by the Nebraska Post-Conviction Act. The first claim is simply erroneous. As this court itself has made clear long ago in its decision in State versus Vella in 2006, the right at issue here is both statutory and constitutional. This court has also emphasized that the right protected by the Nebraska statute 28-105.01, the statute that bars the death penalty for juveniles and persons with intellectual disability, and by the Eighth Amendment, is the right not to be executed where the culpability of the defendant is insufficient to justify the death penalty. The court has stated emphatically that under the Eighth Amendment and Nebraska law, a person with intellectual disability cannot be executed. Moreover, the express language of 28-105.01 subsection 2 states that the death penalty shall not be imposed on a person with intellectual disability, notwithstanding any other provision of law.
Counsel?
Yeah.
I'm a little puzzled by your use of terminology, and it may be that you just misspoke, but you referred to Mr. Lauder as being actually innocent of the death penalty. Don't we normally talk about guilt or innocence in connection with the crime that's committed, not the penalty that may be imposed?
Well, Your Honor, we addressed this issue in our brief, and actual innocence encompasses, at least under federal habeas corpus law, encompasses actual innocence of the death penalty. And under federal habeas corpus law, a successive petition is allowed on the basis of actual innocence, whether it's actual innocence of the crime or actual innocence of the death penalty. And I think you can take that doctrine and apply it to Nebraska, where the court does allow successive petitions based on actual innocence. And that's what we're arguing in our brief.
Counsel, was this issue of intellectual disability raised in the initial proceedings after conviction and on the direct appeal from the imposition of the death penalty?
It was not. It was not.
No determinations about his mental efficiencies or his IQ or anything of that nature?
There was IQ testing done around the time of his trial, and there's been IQ testing that's been done throughout Mr. Lauder's life. And it's really not uncommon in these kinds of cases to see a range of IQ scores throughout the individual's life. And that's just something that has to be weighed, you know, at an evidentiary hearing. I mean, Mr. Lauder's IQ score, according to the testing performed most recently, is a 67. He has historical IQ scores that, you know, are within a range of scores. At age 10, he had an IQ score of 76, and when it's adjusted for the Flynn effect, which means that the norms were outdated on that test when it was performed, the adjustment brings it down to 73.
The state alleges that at the time of the original sentencing, his IQ was 92.
That's right, but I don't dispute that. But again, so we don't know how that.
So does this claim occur whenever the IQ changes? Can it be continually challenged each and every time there's an IQ test with a different rating?
Well, I think it depends on the facts of the case, Your Honor. But I think that you know, an intellectual disability claim is. Raised when, you know, the evidence exists to support a claim of intellectual disability. And so
it would never be procedurally barred then, is that correct?
It is not procedurally barred. It is not procedurally barred under the plain language of the intellectual disability statute. It says notwithstanding any other provision of law. And the reason for that is because a person with intellectual disability cannot be executed, as this court has plainly said.
I beg your pardon. Is your argument to the effect that in 2018 the facts changed so as to be a new day one, or the landscape of jurisprudence changed in 2018, or a combination of those things?
Well, I think it's a combination of those things. First of all, Mr. Lauder was never evaluated for adaptive deficits, which is an important prong of the intellectual disability test. The other thing is that the landscape has changed, because in Moore versus Texas, the Supreme Court did two things. One is that it clearly established that the Constitution prohibits an interpretation of the sub-average intellectual functioning prong of intellectual disability to apply an IQ cutoff. In addition to that, the IQ cutoff is only one part of the intellectual disability test. And this court has never decided, with respect to sub-average intellectual functioning, whether The statute establishes an IQ cutoff, and the Supreme Court has cited the Nebraska statute as among the state statutes that could be interpreted to mandate a strict IQ cutoff. And this court has never decided that issue. It certainly declined to do so in State versus Vela in 2010.
Are we talking about 28105.01?
Yes.
And are you suggesting that the court establish a cutoff, or the statute requires a cutoff, or to the contrary, there is no cutoff, which, hearkening back to Justice Funk's question, therefore, if there is no absolute cutoff, an evolving, perhaps more sophisticated assessment could give you a new day one periodically?
Well, to answer your question about the IQ cutoff, I don't think it's been decided one way or the other whether the statute establishes a strict IQ cutoff score. I mean, the state in State versus Vela in 2010 asked the court to apply such an interpretation to the statute, and the court declined to do so. So it simply hasn't been decided whether it establishes a strict cutoff. But with respect to the adaptive functioning prong of the intellectual disability test, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that portion of the statute itself, but this court has interpreted that provision in a way that's inconsistent with what Moore requires. And that is that in State versus Vela in 2010, the court said that intellectual disability hadn't been proven, relying on adaptive strengths rather than adaptive deficits. And what Moore makes crystal clear is that the intellectual disability determination, that prong of the intellectual disability determination, must focus on adaptive deficits and not adaptive strengths. So your
argument would be to the effect that Moore was in 2017, is that correct?
Yes.
And that you believe it to have implicated a constitutional issue, which would give you a new day one, something to that effect.
Well, I think that in combination with the statute itself, the plain language of which says a person can't be executed if they have intellectual disability, notwithstanding any other provision of law, and that Moore made clear that a court has to apply current medical standards in evaluating a claim of disability, intellectual disability, then I think that does establish a new day one with respect to the facts in this case.
Council, when 28105.01 was enacted initially, it included a provision that allowed defendants who had been sentenced prior to the enactment of the statute to bring a post-conviction claim challenging intellectual disability within 120 days after the effective date of the act. What, if anything, do we make of the language included then and the fact that that language is no longer in the statute?
I don't think it makes any difference with respect to the language that exists now. And, you know, you have to remember that what Moore has done, when Atkins was decided, what the Supreme Court said in Atkins was, we're going to leave it to the states to establish a mechanism for determining whether a person is intellectually disabled. And the court later on in Hall, and then most recently in Moore, you know, backed away from that because states were interpreting intellectual disability determinations in different ways, whether it was a strict IQ cutoff score, and then the adaptive deficits issue, which is most important for purposes of Moore, they were interpreting that in a way that was inconsistent with current medical standards. And so when you get up to Moore clearly established the standards that apply to an intellectual disability determination. And the interpretations under Nebraska law are inconsistent with that. And that inconsistency why that lack of clarity on the standards that apply Why Mr. Lauder couldn't file his claim before 2018 when a full battery of testing under current medical standards was performed.
If you were to prevail, what's the relief that you would obtain? Is Mr. Lauder resentenced? Is there just an order that the death penalty cannot be imposed? What relief are you seeking?
No, Your Honor, we're not asking you to decide Mr. Lauder's the merits of Mr. Lauder's intellectual disability claim in this proceeding. What we're asking for is for you to remand the case back for an evidentiary hearing because
I understand that. I'm saying if you ultimately get an evidentiary hearing and prevail, what's the relief? Is it that he would resentence, that there be an order that the death penalty cannot be imposed, or something else?
Well, because the death penalty violates his constitutional rights, if his intellectual disability is proven, then his death sentence must be vacated. That's the remedy.
If you were successful in that regard, then would that preclude a reevaluation in the future for double jeopardy purposes, or is that a relevant question?
I think that would be dispositive, Your Honor. I mean, the point of the evidentiary hearing would be to bring all of the facts before the district court. And if the state is going to dispute the diagnosis of intellectual disability, which it hasn't done with any facts, then the state would bring facts bearing on that issue and the district court would decide based on the evidence that's presented.
So if there were a hearing and you were to prevail and there was a resentence, would that stand for the proposition that Mr. Lauder had been acquitted of a death sentence?
Yes, I think ultimately. I think that, the state could appeal from a determination of intellectual disability, but the remedy for a finding of intellectual disability is to vacate the death sentence.
Counsel, you allude that facts change, testing and examination processes become more refined. If that were to be the case, and a retesting of Mr. Lauder showed that his IQ was above 70, the state doesn't have the right to go back and seek the death penalty done at that point?
I think once his intellectual disability is determined, I think that's dispositive. Now, if at some point in time there were another IQ test that indicated an IQ score of 70 or even above 70, I don't think that excludes the diagnosis of intellectual disability because IQ is not dispositive. The subaverage intellectual functioning exists concurrently with adaptive deficits. And Mr. Lauder shows severe adaptive deficits. And I think what the Supreme Court has made very clear is that IQ is a range, not a number. So you can't rely on a particular number in intellectual testing to decide whether a person is intellectually disabled or not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Woodman.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith, good morning to you. And you must be muted, Mr. Smith.
I saw Judge Stacy letting me know. Yes, I was muted. May it please the court, James Smith, Senior Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska. Lauder's intellectual disability claim is both time barred and procedurally barred.
Mr. Smith, if we set aside the argument, procedural bar and time bar, does the state have any argument that the allegations of the fifth post-conviction motion are somehow insufficient to warrant an evidentiary hearing?
Well, I guess my response would be, if you set aside my entire argument, that's where you would end up. I would note his petition does not, contrary to what counsel said, say that he was never evaluated for intellectual disability. The Aikens intellectual disability standard was established in 2002. There's no allegation in the subsequent 16 years before filing the post-conviction motion that he was never evaluated, that he was never determined to be intellectually disabled during all of those intervening years. I think that's significant in the context of when he finally made this claim. So I think that is something that is important. I think it's important for the court to note that the assignment of error claim constitutional, not statutory error, per the 18th and 14th Amendments. The summary of argument in the appellant's brief is also based on constitutional, not statutory claims. So obviously my brief responded to constitutional claims, not statutory claims, since that was what was alleged and argued. It is, the claim is time barred under the post-conviction's 1 year time period. The date on which the factual predicate of the constitutional claims alleged could have been discovered through the exercise of due diligence. We've had 16 years since Aikens. Obviously, that would refute the due diligence. It's no claim has been made in that intervening 16 years. No allegation was ever made that he was never evaluated. No allegation was ever made that if he was evaluated in the past, it made different conclusions. All we get is an allegation that, gee, we went and had him evaluated in 2018, 16 years later. That's not due diligence. As far as the sub D of the post-conviction statute of limitations, the date on when a constitutional claim was initially recognized, if made applicable retroactively to cases on post-conviction review, that would be the Aikens case. Neither Hall nor Moore have been held to establish new rules that are retroactive. I would cite the case of State v. Jackson. It's an Ohio case, 159 Northeast 3rd, 1153. The reason I cite that case is it gives a long string citation of all of the courts in which that court notes there is a substantial and growing body of law that has declined to apply Hall and Moore retroactively. And the Jackson case then gives you a string cite of all of those cases. This, of course, is Lauder's fifth post-conviction proceeding. His second and third post-conviction proceedings after Aikens made actual innocence claims, didn't claim intellectual disability, but he did claim actual innocence. This court's opinion in 2009 on Lauder's post-conviction proceeding says it was his second proceeding, was actually his third. This court had summarily denied his second appeal from denial of post-conviction. I would refer the court to Judge Cuff's habeas order in 2011. It does give a very excellent summary of the history of Lauder's direct appeal, his and his post-conviction proceedings. And so the fact that this court in 2009 rejected what it said was his second post-conviction proceeding, it was actually his third. The opinion in 2009 does point out that he made an actual innocence claim in that case, which was again denied.
Could you respond to opposing counsel's argument that procedural bar, time bar, none of these doctrines are applicable because of the language that says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, the death penalty shall not be imposed?
Well, first of all, that's a statutory claim, Your Honor. What she is citing is 28-105. That's a statutory claim. It's not constitutional. Her assignment of error was constitutional claims, not statutory. So I think constitutionally, you have to go to Aikens, which then talks about what the constitutional standard is, what it called mental retardation, now intellectual disability. But it also describes in Aikens a retardation that became manifest before age 18 for constitutional purposes. I would cite Bourgeois v. Watson, 977 F3rd 620, Seventh Circuit case 2020, which describes intellectual disability as a permanent condition that must manifest itself before age 18. There is no allegation that his intellectual disability is the result of a traumatic injury. Rather, they're going back to, and seeing the report they attach, long-standing circumstances before age 18. So that report really is doing the Atkins formulary for intellectual disability.
I didn't understand Ms. Woodman's argument to be a statutory claim. I understood her argument to be 28-105.01, particularly the language that says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, that removes the application of doctrines of procedural bar and time bar. How would you respond to that?
My response to that would be that the statute does not excuse the procedural bar provisions of state law, that you do have to make your assertions at the earliest opportunity. Otherwise, you just keep coming back, There is a reason for the procedural bar.
It does say notwithstanding any other provision of law. Doesn't that usually mean that what follows is going to trump other legal doctrines?
I don't think it would, notwithstanding, I don't think it trumps just the procedural bar that you've got to raise it in a timely manner, rather than just saying you get to keep coming back. The court's procedural bar rule, I think, is a legitimate rule the court can apply. I would also cite the U.S. Supreme Court decision in McQuiggan v. Perkins. I think it's cited in the briefs, but it's 569 U.S. 383, that court did say the timing of a petition should seriously undermine the credibility of an actual innocence claim. And in that case, the fact that the claim was not timely made, and they cite the Schlupp standards demanding for actual innocence, it's a very demanding standard in which the timing of actually making such a claim can be a bar to the claim. So even the U.S. Supreme Court recognizes in the actual innocence context that there can be a time bar, procedural bar, that's applied to such a claim.
I beg your pardon. I think the inference is being made that there's an evolution of sophistication of testing, and as a result of that, there's more information that comports with more to the effect of adaptive deficits, which is has become more into focus. So with that in mind, and possibly the evolution of testing, if there were a hearing and if the court were to determine that Mr. Lauder is not eligible for the death penalty, would that end the matter with respect to sentencing? In other words, would he stand, quote unquote, acquitted of that penalty, and thereafter there's double jeopardy with respect to imposition of the death penalty?
I'd confess I haven't analyzed it in the context of double jeopardy. Their brief doesn't make that type of an argument. I think, to me, I'd really be guessing and speculating as to where that ends up, and I don't think now's probably not the time for me to do that.
Mr. Smith, I understand your argument this morning to be suggesting that the phrase, notwithstanding any other provision of law, should not be construed to apply to the time and procedural bars elsewhere in statute and our jurisprudence. Help me understand the rule of statutory construction that you are urging us to apply to get to that result.
I guess where I would get to that result is when the rule of procedural bar has been applied, I don't think it's just, you would have to then say we're going to apply it so that there will be never ending opportunities to keep coming back to raise the same issue. And that to me really leads to somewhat of an odd result that this court would say we're going to allow repeated ongoing post-conviction motions raising the same issue over and over and over again, and it would never end, which would to me fly in the face of the basic concept of law of finality.
Is this an absurd results argument?
To me, it would be. To me, it would be an argument that that statute is construed so that there will never be an end to litigation.
Is that a matter for the legislature or the courts?
I think it's a matter for the court on its construction, especially when we're looking at a fifth post-conviction motion that you would write an opinion that we will now construe this, that we can have post-conviction proceedings ad infinitum. And so anyone who ever wants to make an intellectual disability claim, we're always going to have hearings, and we're going to have repeated hearings and repeated hearings. That's where this ends. And it doesn't end then. You've essentially repealed the death penalty judicially.
There are no other questions, Mr. Smith. Thank you very much. And do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments in State versus Lotter. Counsel, thank you very much for participating by WebEx. You are excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Wyszynski versus State of Nebraska.